Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I'm your host. Today we're talking about bronchiectasis, its management and diagnosis, and how GPs are perfectly placed to provide gold standard care to their patients. Dr. Simone Visser, a respiratory physician at Royal Prince Alfred, and Clinical Associate Professor Lucy Morgan, a senior respiratory specialist at Concord Repatriation General Hospital, are co-authors on a new narrative review of bronchiectasis, which is published in the MJA. They are my special guests on the pod today. What is bronchiectasis?
Bronchiectasis is a chronic lung disease, which is specifically defined as really an anatomical abnormality of dilated or widened bronchi on a CT chest scan. And yeah, this dilatation or widening of the airways means that there's a cycle of retained mucus and airway infection and inflammation and worsening structural damage occurring in the airways. And so this then causes a clinical syndrome of bronchiectasis, which is one of a chronic cough, usually with sputum production each day and recurrent respiratory tract infections.
Do we know what causes it?
We are aware of a diverse range of conditions that can lead to what we think of as the sort of common endpoint, which is the airway dilatation. And I guess probably the most common of these is previous severe lower respiratory tract infections. For example, childhood pertussis or perhaps a severe adenoviral infection. And that group is called post-infective bronchiectasis, and that accounts for approximately one-third of cases. But there's also a number of other causes. For example, connective tissue diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, immunodeficiency conditions, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. There's actually about, you know, at least one quarter to one half of patients that we are unable to easily define the underlying cause of their disease, and they're sort of left with the label of idiopathic bronchiectasis. It's probable that we just don't have the correct tests, and so we can't pick up potential subtle immune abnormalities, for example.
So is there room for lots more research about it?
There certainly is, yeah, this is one of the reasons why the Australian Bronchiectasis Registry has been formed, and there's many, many different avenues for research within bronchiectasis, from pathogenesis to the natural history of disease, prognosis and treatment. So, you know, the registry is one way in which to, I guess, foster a growing interest in this condition and hopefully foster ongoing research in this condition, which has previously been slightly neglected in research.
Simone's description is elegant in the extreme, but I kind of think of bronchiectasis in a slightly more simplistic. Or it is, you know, you can think of bronchiectasis in a possibly a more simplistic way. Mm-hmm. You know, if we think of the lung as being like sponge cake, and that the air gets into the lung as if down straws or tubes, which are the bronchi. So bronchiectasis is the process by which the airways, the bronchi, become floppy and dilated from being chronically inflamed. So if you were to cut a bit of good sponge cake in through the middle of a good sponge cake and look at it, that's what normal lung looks like.
Right.
Relatively soft and springy, relatively small holes with tiny tapering airways going through that sponge cake. So if you cut it down the bottom of the sponge cake, you have very, very tiny, tiny little holes of the airways. And if you thought, and if you put next to that sponge cake a crumpet, you know what a crumpet looks
like? Yes, I do.
It's a bit leathery, it's a bit tough,
yep.
and there are holes in it. And if you pour butter and honey onto a crumpet, you know exactly what happens.
Yes.
The butter and honey kind of ends up, you know, tucked in, hiding away in the crumpety holes.
Yes.
And that's a bit like what happens in bronchiectasis. So the bronchiectatic lung, or the lung of a patient with bronchiectasis, has airways that are much bigger and floppier and dilated, like the holes of the crumpet.
Yep.
And they're filled up with mucus, sputum. Yep. I don't want to have a food analogy, really, but it's the fact that the sputum builds up and hides in these holes that causes the chronic symptoms of cough. So anything can cause the sorts of things that can cause normal spongy lung to end up like crumpety lung are really in sort of three or four categories. It's anything that blocks those airways.
Yeah.
So that blockage or obstruction can be within the airway, sort of an endobronchial, things like a foreign body, a bit of Lego or a pea, or a tumour can block an airway, and so that beyond that blockage, the airway gets floppy and dilated. You can have extrinsic obstruction, so something squashing the airway from outside, and that's things like lymph nodes that get swollen in infections like tuberculosis. One of the common causes of bronchiectasis throughout the world is still post-tuberculous bronchiectasis, where the glands or the lymph nodes in the chest swell and block and squish off the airway, and so the airway can't drain the mucus. And so post-tuberculous bronchiectasis is actually about extrinsic compression of the airway. Or it can be intrinsic compression, where the airway itself gets swollen and narrowed. And that's in conditions like asthma, actually, or where undertreated or incompletely treated asthma, it leads to a process where all the airways are narrow and swollen, and therefore the mucus can't drain out properly. So those are the sorts of things that can cause it. Obviously, there are very, very heterogeneous. A whole lot of different things can lead to, as Simone says, the single process, which is this crumpety lung. And, of course, anything that gives you immunoparesis, where your immune system doesn't work properly, means you're more likely to get infections. And nasty infections in the lung are a very, very common cause of bronchiectasis.
Okay.
And then there are some rarer things, like problems with your respiratory cilia that stop mucus being moved within the airway, and even things like problems with the mucus, which is why cystic fibrosis causes bronchiectasis. So one of the things Simone and I are particularly interested in is bronchiectasis that's not due to cystic fibrosis.
Right.
Because there are some very specific things about CF and the bronchiectasis you get from CF. One of the most important differences is that it's highly researched.
Yeah.
So there's lots of stuff been done by lots of clever people in CF, but not so much research into the causes or the impact on patients of having bronchiectasis that's not due to CF.
Do you know what the prevalence is? Do we know exactly what's going on in Australia?
So that's one of the extraordinary things. This is thought to be probably very, very common, but remarkably, we really don't know. There are no good prevalence data for bronchiectasis in Australia.
Yep.
We have some clues. We know that bronchiectasis is very common in Indigenous Australians, 10 times more common than non-Indigenous Australians, at least. But other than that, we really don't know very much about it at all, which is surprising when you think of how much we know about asthma and COPD.
Yeah.
But again, as Simone said, one of the absolute reasons why we have set up the Australasian Bronchiectasis Registry Project to try and get a handle on just how common it is and where people with bronchiectasis live and where do they seek their treatment for bronchiectasis and are there differences of equity of access to good care for patients with bronchiectasis. We really don't know any of that. And that's one of the reasons that we've set up the registry.
Is it misdiagnosed a lot?
It's likely that it's significantly underdiagnosed, because to actually make the diagnosis, you've got to think about it first. It's got to be in your list of differential diagnoses.
Yep.
And then you actually need to have a CT scan to make the diagnosis. One of the problems we think is that the symptoms of bronchiectasis are incredibly common. So, you know, chronic cough is the hallmark of clinically significant bronchiectasis. There are lots of things that can cause chronic cough. It's not so much that there are differential diagnoses for bronchiectasis, but the more important message is that bronchiectasis is a very important differential diagnosis for a very common symptom, and that's cough.
Yeah.
So if you've got a patient in front of you that's got chronic cough, particularly chronic productive cough, coughing up muck, and particularly in patients who are having frequent chest infections that are requiring antibiotics, it's really very important that clinicians think about bronchiectasis as a potential cause of that symptom and order a CT scan. So it's not hard to diagnose if you think about it. It doesn't take expensive tests, and it doesn't take difficult to interpret tests to make a diagnosis.
Right.
It just takes a good history taking, a good history taking, listen to your patient, and then order it and order a CT scan.
If somebody's got bronchiectasis, what is their quality of life like if they're a severe sufferer?
Simone, do you want to talk to that? Sure. Patients with bronchiectasis have a significantly impaired quality of life.
Mm.
Unfortunately, as is the case with the lack of prevalence data, there is also a lack of quality of life data for this condition. However, it is thought to be similar to the impairment that is seen in patients with severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. And we're just starting within the bronchiectasis world to have some sort of disease-specific tools to measure somebody's quality of life. We hope that with the registry, we will be able to collect quality of life data. And our interim analysis does suggest that for our patients on the registry, the quality of life is significantly impaired.
Mm.
And that's something that we hope to analyse further and publish in the near future.
The symptom burden, Kate, gets worse as the disease progresses.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are periods of time when the symptoms are worse than baseline, and that's the concept of exacerbation or flare-up.
Yeah.
That's one of the hallmarks of bronchiectasis is chronic symptoms, so cough, productive of sputum, most days and most nights, or the whole time. So the burden of illness and the symptomatology is partly respiratory. So there's the cough and there's the sputum, which is foul and often smelly and tastes bad and affects people's sense of, their appetite, how sexy they feel and whether they feel like kissing other people,
exactly,
whether they've got
bad
breath, all of those subtle things that are hard to, it's a very antisocial problem, really.
Yeah.
Lots of my patients talk about how embarrassed they are to go to the opera or to sit in church or to sit in a lecture theatre or to be a nurse or a clinician or a school teacher, whatever it is that they do for work, because they're coughing the whole time, because they've often got to go away from their workplace to cough up foul sputum, let alone the time required for the treatments that we think are recommended for them, which can take up a lot of time. And then there are the non-specific symptoms, sort of somewhat systemic symptoms like fatigue, tiredness. People don't sleep well when they cough all night. Their partnerships get fragile because their partners don't sleep well because they cough all night.
Yeah.
Weight loss, not having that much energy. And then there's the times when they have to be in hospital because their flare-up is so severe that they need intravenous antibiotics, sometimes oxygen therapy, those kinds of things. So there's a really big impact with having a chronic respiratory disease. And we think bronchiectasis has a burden of disease that's actually exponentially higher than many of the other well-studied chronic respiratory diseases.
How long has the registry been up and running?
We started recruiting only just on 2 years ago.
Okay.
And we've already recruited 1,000 patients nationally. That doesn't sound like a lot, 1,000 patients in 20 million Australians, but we've only got 20 hospital sites recruiting, and that's 1,000 patients in 2 years. So there's enormous demand from patients for research into bronchiectasis. They feel really very neglected as a respiratory disease. They're often, patients with bronchiectasis are often excluded from other respiratory clinical trials. So they're excluded from the COPD trials.
Mm-hmm.
They're excluded from the asthma trials. And as Simone, I think, mentioned earlier, there are no medications at all registered specifically for the use in bronchiectasis. So patients with bronchiectasis feel a little bit unloved, I've got to say, by the system.
So talking about treatments, if there's no specific medications for it, are there off-label treatments in terms of pharmacology, or is it are we relying on things like airway clearance and that sort of thing? Are there any pharmacological answers?
So as you mentioned, Kate, the frontline treatment really is airway clearance. And I think if you imagine Lucy's crumpet example with honey and butter, you can understand why, you know, doing daily airway clearance would be so important.
Yes.
You know, we do recommend that patients see a specialised respiratory physiotherapist who can actually teach them techniques for airway clearance and can personalise a regime for them. And many patients will have to do airway clearance every day. Perhaps some patients may only need to perform airway clearance when they're unwell with a flare-up. And fortunately, you know, if patients are diligent with airway clearance, many can be maintained on an airway clearance regimen alone without the need for any additional medical therapy. But the specific sort of groups of medications that we do consider for patients with bronchiectasis firstly, antibiotics. There are a few situations in which antibiotics are necessary. For example, if somebody has a flare-up, so an exacerbation where their cough and sputum gets worse and their breathlessness gets worse, we would usually intervene early on with either an oral antibiotic or an intravenous antibiotic, depending on the severity of their exacerbation, and treat them with antibiotics for a period of, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. And antibiotics can be used in other settings as well. For example, in certain patients that have severe recurrent exacerbations, we may consider inhaled antibiotics. But access to inhaled antibiotics is actually incredibly difficult, even for, you know, a tertiary centre. So that would be the minority of patients that are on inhaled antibiotics.
Simone Visser and Lucy Morgan are respiratory physicians, and they're with me today to talk all things bronchiectasis. Their co-authored narrative review on the subject can be found at nja.com.au.
The other group of medications that we do consider in this group of patients is low-dose macrolide antibiotics. These type of antibiotics actually, we use them in this condition for their anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory action. And they're probably the only medication within the bronchiectasis literature that has quite good randomised controlled trial evidence.
Oh, cool.
And meta-analysis evidence that these agents reduce pulmonary exacerbations. But it is very important to also realise that these antibiotics have certain risks, such as the risk of bacterial resistance, as well as certain side effects. And so we would really only choose these macrolide antibiotics in a very selected group of patients that have very severe or recurrent exacerbations, despite otherwise optimal management.
You mentioned resistance. That's always a hot button topic with antibiotics. Is there a build-up of resistance in this particular community yet?
Patients with bronchiectasis typically do develop over time as the bacteria sit in their lungs. They typically develop resistance and resistant bacteria as time goes on. However, there's also macrolides have only been in use for this condition probably in the last 5 to 10 years perhaps. And we have seen certain trials have showed increased rates of macrolide resistance, but we are or exactly what that means yet. So it's more a watch this space and be very cautious and select your patients well at this point.
Okay.
With regard to the macrolide antibiotics.
Is surgery an option at all?
Surgery is rarely undertaken in patients with bronchiectasis.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of cases where you would consider surgery. The first would be if the patient has very localised focal area of bronchiectasis, and you may be able to cut out that bit of lung and significantly improve their symptoms and exacerbations.
Mm-hmm.
And the other situation would really be if the patient has significant hemoptysis, which is where they are coughing up blood, and you can't control the hemoptysis through any other means, such as certain medications or embolising the arteries that are responsible. So it would be a last-stage treatment for refractory hemoptysis.
Okay, what about transplants?
Bilateral transplant is certainly an option for certain younger patients that have severe disease and no contraindications. And I guess historically patients with bronchiectasis were considered to be poor candidates for transplant because there was a concern that the persistence of infection had the potential to worsen when patients were placed on immunosuppression after their transplant. But bilateral lung transplant, we've now seen over time that the survival advantage of patients with a transplant for bronchiectasis appears to be comparable to patients with a transplant for another reason. So bilateral lung transplant can be undertaken in patients with severe disease for this condition.
Our goal really is to minimise the number of patients whose bronchiectasis progresses so badly that they even need transplant. And there are multiple opportunities for us to improve, sort of stop things getting getting that bad.
Yeah,
I think that's our real goal. We want to minimise those who even need a transplant.
Does that include things like mucoactive agents, bronchodilators, corticosteroids, those sort of things?
Well, in bronchiectasis, we do sometimes use short-acting bronchodilators, such as salbutamol, which is commonly known as Ventolin. That is only recommended prior to using other nebulized therapies, and that would help to improve the tolerability and deposition of the other thing that they were nebulizing. However, the routine use of bronchodilators or inhaled corticosteroids for bronchiectasis is really not recommended. The use has actually been extrapolated from the asthma and COPD literature, and it's really not supported by any high-level evidence for bronchiectasis. And so, again, it's not routinely recommended purely for bronchiectasis. The caveat would be that certain patients have bronchiectasis with asthma or bronchiectasis with COPD.
Yes.
And those patients should be, prescribed inhaled corticosteroids and or long-acting bronchodilators as appropriate for their concomitant COPD or asthma, but not purely based on the fact that they have bronchiectasis. In clinic, we do even sometimes try to wean appropriate patients off their inhalers gradually under monitoring.
If you had a magic wand, where would you like to direct the research funds to now?
Okay, if a magic wand implies that I've got an
some kind of superpower,
yeah, I've got a superpower and I've got unlimited money too.
Yeah,
I think the thing about the registry. So the first thing is the registry. So the registry gives us an opportunity to really explore what I would call medical clinical cartography, the ability to map out this disease process in Australia, a roadmap, It gives us the opportunity to see how many people have got this process and how it's affecting their lives. It allows us to get an awful lot of information about the severity of their bronchiectasis, the severity of their lung function abnormality, the severity or, the impact of the bugs that are in their airways and how resistant these bugs are, the impact on the patient's finances and our community's finances, the financial burden of this process, everything from how many times a year do they have to go to the GP, how many times a year do they have to go on oral antibiotics, how many times a year does that oral antibiotic mean they also have to go on probiotic and some kind of thrush treatment? Yeah. How many times do these people end up having to miss work and school? How much time do they spend in hospital? what happens to them in hospital and what are the costs and the burdens of those hospital admissions? What does it cost our community for those patients to be in hospital? All of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
We really don't know. And we know that for, this is a condition that affects young Australians and older Australians.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of our registry is looking at how many children are affected with bronchiectasis, as well as adolescents, as well as older Australians. So we're getting the feeling as we map this disease that this is a big country with a lot of with a lot of patients with this condition, and unlike a condition that only affects older people, that the impact on work and school and education and normal younger lives is something that's really important. So I think the registry is about mapping. That doesn't necessarily change clinical practice, but one of the things that happens when you map something is you have a greater sense of where you're going, and you can follow street signs and you can start to signpost things better. And I think this will lead to us being able to have much more evidence-based clinical guidelines to help raise clinical awareness amongst our colleagues of what to do if you see a patient who's bronchiectasis is burdensome to them, how to investigate them, how to manage them better. And it also raises the profile, if you like, in all sorts of categories. In clinical research, one of the things that we've noticed is just how few respiratory physiotherapists there are around the track. There are small numbers of respiratory physiotherapists funded for ivory towers, and even fewer out on the ground, out in rural and regional Australia, let alone the outer suburbs of our biggest cities. And this is an area, these are clinicians who are delivering incredibly cost-effective, safe and useful treatments to these patients, and we haven't got enough respiratory physios. So raising awareness about those kinds of things, patient-initiated and patient-centred clinical research, using patients to help us to design the research questions that that we really need to answer. That's really important for us. Patient support and education. So this, the Australian Bronchiectasis Registry has been, has got going under the auspices of Lung Foundation Australia, an organisation absolutely there for patient support and education. And one of the things we're noticing is just how many patients ring up the Lung Foundation and say, I've got bronchiectasis, but I don't have a bronchiectasis doctor and I don't know where to go to find information. And so developing appropriate online and written patient information has been very important to us too.
If I had a magic wand, i.e. an unlimited bucket of money, I would probably be donating it to the registry, and that will enable us, through the registry, we can do research, we can provide support to patients, we can streamline patients into clinical trials, we can raise the profile of bronchiectasis research in Australia, we can get young researchers interested in bronchiectasis, and we can keep the registry going and improve the processes. So I think that's what I would do.
There's a large chunk of our listeners who are GPs. Is there a message for them about their patients with these kind of problems?
Well, I was just going to reinforce Lucy's message that if a patient has a chronic cough which is productive of sputum, to think of bronchiectasis as a differential in the other list of differentials that GPs are very much aware of, such as asthma, COPD, lung cancer, and to perform a CT scan. And ideally that would be a high resolution CT scan. And that will essentially give you the diagnosis as well as ruling out other potentially nasty diagnoses such as lung cancer. That would be the first thing. And the second thing would be that a respiratory specialist would be very happy to review any patient with bronchiectasis. So a referral is always appreciated and useful for the patient. And then thirdly, I guess, airway clearance is paramount in this patient.
What about you, Lucy?
Our colleagues in primary care are perfectly positioned to diagnose and manage most patients with bronchiectasis. And so I think Simone's first point is absolutely right. Think of it. Have it on your your list of important causes of chronic cough. They're not the people that are going to turn up to emergency departments. They're actually the patients that are going to bubble around in primary care. The ivory towers don't need to see most patients with bronchiectasis. If I was a GP and I'd made a new diagnosis, the first thing I would do would be to culture the sputum. So knowing what's in the zoo or knowing what bugs are colonising the airways of a patient with bronchiectasis when they're stable is really, really, really powerful. It's really cheap. But it's really useful. It's really good bang for your buck because if they have a flare-up where their symptoms are much, much worse for a bit and they come to you with worse cough, worse, more purulent sputum, muckier cough and more breathlessness, then the choice of an empiric antibiotic to give them to see if they settle down will be driven by what you know is colonising their airways. So a sputum culture when they're stable that identifies Haemophilus influenzae, for example, one of the commonest colonising pathogens, means that when they flare up, you choose an antibiotic that you know they're not allergic to that will cover Haemophilus. And that can be your first line. And then if the patient deteriorates or needs hospitalisation, then they go to hospital and then somebody else is in charge of that. So make the diagnosis and know what's in the zoo in their sputum so that you can make a sensible empiric choice about antibiotics. And then it's about what can you do to reduce their risk of exacerbation. Yeah. The commonest cause of exacerbation for bronchiectasis is actually viral respiratory tract infection, the same rhinovirus, adenovirus, influenza that we all catch. I know it sounds really obvious, but vaccination. Yeah. So influenza vaccination, pneumococcal vaccination is very, very important.
Yep.
And then sensible things that reduce your risk of catching colds. So talk about hand hygiene, talk about avoiding sick contacts if you can. So if you're a grandparent with bronchiectasis and the kids and the grandkids have snotty noses and temperatures, that's not a great time for you to be babysitting them, school holidays. So I think, you know, things like that are a really important way of reducing people's risk of catching flu-like viruses, cold and flu viruses.
Yep.
And that makes a really big difference. And keeping all patients fit, healthy, vaccinated and not smoking, really important ways of protecting people from deteriorating. Who should they refer to a respiratory specialist?
Yep.
I think the patient who is having more than two flare-ups requiring two exacerbations per year, or the patient who continues to have a very heavy burden of symptoms despite what you think is maximal augmented sputum clearance or airway clearance treatment, they're the patients who should be sent to a specialist bronchiectasis doctor.
Okay. Can GPs register their patients individually with the registry?
Not at this stage, no.
Okay.
We're working towards the opportunity for patients to self-report and self-register, and for GPs to be able to register. But just at the moment, for funding reasons, really, we've started with tertiary referral hospitals, and we're planning, if funding allows us, to roll out to secondary and primary care in the future.
Thanks both for your time.
Okay.
Terrific.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.